From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For 5 years now, we've been moaning about the economy. It's been bad, but somehow we got used to bad. Now it may be turning around, and people are fretting for all kinds of new reasons. Seeing black clouds, says one report, behind the silver linings. Mortgage rates go up a titch from historic lows, bond yields jump. People sweat. This hour On Point, the new economic winds and a hot debate about what they mean. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is this it? The turnaround. How will you measure a turn from bad times to good? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by the renowned fiscal conservative, economist Martin Feldstein. His eyes are still locked on long-term debt. And later in the hour, we'll hear from Robert Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect and author of the new book, Debtor's Prison. But first, from Baltimore, we're joined by Robert Barbera, co-director of the Center for Financial Economics at Johns Hopkins University, formerly chief economist at Lehman Brothers, at E.F. Hutton, at ITG. He's author of The Cost of Capitalism, Understanding Market Mayhem and Stabilizing Our Economic Future. Appears frequently on CNBC and Bloomberg News. Robert Barbera, welcome. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very curious about what's making people have sweaty palms when the news has appeared to be good. Now, we saw that, the market down 200 points or something on Friday, but hey, that's the market. I'm reading Floyd Norris here in the New York Times. It says American markets are getting worried again, but this time because economic growth may be about to accelerate. Why is that making people uneasy, Robert?
Well, I think, remember now, the commentary is dominated by the financial markets.
Yeah.
And people have thought that since the stock market benefited from the easy money from the central bank, from the Fed, if the economy looks better, the simplistic view is then the Fed will stop being easy and this will really be a dastardly development for the equity market.
So the Fed's been pumping $85 billion a month into bonds. And explain to us what the impact of that has been and how it may be in part behind the big stock run-up.
Well, I think straightforwardly, you know, the Feds are always in the business when the economy is doing poorly of trying to raise bond prices, push people out the risk curve and restart animal spirits, get the economy going.
In other words, to push them back into the stock market by making bonds unattractive?
To push them back into taking risks. Among those risks are stocks. Other risks are starting businesses, you know, getting back into the business of a growing economy with better asset markets.
Doing stuff instead of just clipping coupons or relying on bond investments.
Perfectly put.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the Fed said that they were going to keep doing this quantitative easing, easy money thing, I thought, until unemployment came down dramatically, maybe through next year. Is that in doubt?
Well, again now, there are some green shoots. We've seen this movie before and been disappointed. But there's some indication that maybe we're going to get to the promised land quicker than we thought, which would mean the Fed could ease up on their easing proposition somewhat quicker. That's been weighing on the bond market. Recently, it weighed on the stock market. Just to be clear here, I think good news in the fullness of time is good news, period. Good news for stocks as well as the economy. But it would be unsettling in the short run for bonds and therefore might give us a hiccup in stocks.
I mean, you wrote, just today or yesterday, shock, horror, the pace of U.S. recovery may be accelerating. What's the scenario that worries the people who are fretting most now? If the Fed starts pulling back on its big purchases, what's the scenario that would get people worried about the economy?
Well, you know, you can make the case that the rise for interest rates will short circuit this. Actually, I think the rise for interest rates, if it occurs, would be reflecting of something more vibrant. So I don't think it gets short circuited. I think if the data are better, you know, Ma and Pa, the man or the lady in the street, had the right reaction, that's good news.
We saw mortgage rates go up in the last couple of weeks for the first time in a long time. Is that the sign of interest rates turning up again?
If the economy is doing better, we would expect interest rates to go up some. That happened in 1983, 1984. That happened in 1993, 1994. We went from a tentative recovery to strong recovery. Rates went up, but the recovery continued.
So how do you look at this economic moment? Do you see health? And if so, why? And what's the source of confidence that it has legs beyond the Fed's easy money policy?
Yeah, I think the important point is to remember that many people who were warning of a big rise for interest rates and a catastrophic end to stock advance and the economy were warning about a rise for interest rates for very different reasons. They were worried about the deficit. They were worried about the dollar. They were worried about inflation. We just got news on the deficit. It's much smaller than expected. We just got news on inflation. It's been going down, not up, and the dollar's done pretty well. So the people who've been saying this bond market's going to get killed, kill stocks and the economy, those were because we were supposed to get news that policy was going badly. Instead, deficit lower, dollar higher, inflation lower, but economic recovery now may be firming up. Well, if interest rates go up because things are better, that's time for champagne, not for eating crow.
How does the Fed unwind these trillions that it's pumped into the economy? And honestly, I'm not even sure what that means, but everybody's writing about it and talking about it. What does unwinding mean? How do they do it? How do they get back out of that role without hitting the economy?
Yeah, well, and let's be fair here. I mean, this is uncharted territory. Traditionally, what the Fed had to do was simply take back some of the interest rate decline. Now they've swelled their balance sheet. They have a great many treasuries. But the fact is they can simply slow and then stop their purchases and then allow for the natural passage of time to shrink their balance sheet, right? You've got a bunch of five-year treasuries. In 5 years, they're all gone.
Mm-hmm. So they don't have to be pouring?
They won't be in the business of selling.
Right.
You know, we won't be having quarterly refundings from the Fed.
Paul Volcker was talking recently at the Economic Club of New York about how it's not unprecedented. He said if you go back to 1949, when things were tough after the war and you had government debt exceeding 100% of GDP and you had, like now, historically low interest rates. And he said, look, we came out of that.
No, I think, you know, I'm embarrassed when I talk to a lot of the youngsters on Wall Street because I remember 82. It's nice to hear somebody who remembers 52. But that's exactly right. A period of good growth lifts interest rates, and it's the growth that lifts the interest rates, and it's a sign of better times ahead. Now, I do want to point out we have some green shoots. Mm-hmm. I'm not sitting here telling you I know that the next 6 months are much better than the last 6 months. There's some indication that that might be true. But we're not sure yet.
I mean, Ben Bernanke talked about green shoots for a couple of different years now where that didn't turn out. It did turn out for the stock market, but Americans have learned acutely that that doesn't necessarily translate into anything for a lot of people who aren't in the market, most people, and we haven't seen wages go up. What about, you know, where it matters for most Americans in their wage packet and a job?
Yeah, I think if we separate those two, on the job front, there is a lot of evidence that things are better, right? We've had a meaningful decline in jobless claims. We've had a meaningful decline in the unemployment rate. Some of that is because people left the labor force, but a fair amount of it is because we've had job growth. The first 4 months of this year, payroll gains average about 195,000. So the job picture does look better, and you see that in the consumer sentiment surveys. They think it looks better. On the wage front, you're absolutely right. The fact that there are still a lot of people battling for those jobs mean that in the negotiation between employer and laborer, the employer still is in the front seat. So I think the job picture is better, but you're going to wait on the notion that you've got some leverage on the wage front.
What kind of growth do you think is required to get that unfrozen? It's been frozen or even down sometimes for a long time.
Well, it's a matter of, again, getting the unemployment rate down. If we had fast growth, we'd get there sooner. But I think the unemployment rate, you know, a percentage point lower than it is now, as the Fed says, at 6.5, you're going to have some leverage. And maybe in 12 to 18 months, we'll be there.
Are we going to hear something more explicit from the Federal Reserve Bank, from Ben Bernanke, about what they're going to do or not do? You know, there was that end of 2014 notion out there, plus the unemployment benchmark. When would it hit 6.5%? But then I guess Bernanke himself hinting that there might be something earlier, maybe even this summer, where they'd start to back out of their big purchases. Do we just have to watch and see what they do, or do you expect them to say something about their plans?
Well, again, one of the things to remember about the Fed is that they have some powerful tools, but they're as blind about the future as we are. And so the Fed will communicate to us a change in heart about the pace of buying and when they might end their purchases, if and when the data change. And you made a very important point. We've had two false dawns in this expansion to date, two period where for 3 or 4 months it looked pretty snappy and then it dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
You got to figure Bernanke and company are going to want to see several months of strength.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the change in the economic weather and whether this is really it, the road to good times, or another false dawn, as my guest Robert Barbera has said. He's co-director of the Center for Financial Economics at Johns Hopkins University. He joins us from Baltimore this hour. And with us right now from New York is Martin Feldstein, professor of economics at Harvard University, former chief economic advisor and chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Ronald Reagan. He was appointed by President Obama to be a member of the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board in 2009, a very big figure in economic circles, conservative economic circles. Martin Feldstein, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
How do you look at what a lot of people have been interpreting in recent weeks as this year's green shoots, maybe more durable than those of last year and the year before?
Well, I hope that's right, but I must say the evidence is certainly not in yet. The first quarter was a strong number, almost 2.5%.
GDP growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, GDP growth. But most of that, or much of that, was just building inventory. So if you look at actual final sales to consumers, to businesses, to exports, it was less than our growth rate last year, 1.5%.
So and what does that suggest to you about the overall health of the economy?
I think it's still very weak. I think it's weak, and housing is good. The stock market is good, but it's being maintained by consumers shrinking their savings and borrowing to levels that we haven't seen for many years. The most recent saving rate was well below 3%. We haven't seen a savings rate, that is to say household savings as a share of after-tax income. We haven't seen savings rates that low since 2007, and the usual number is 4 or 5%. So if households move back to a normal savings level, then consumer spending will slow and we will once again have a very weak expansion.
Maybe it's natural that saving rates would go down right now because if people's optimism turns up and they've put off significant purchases for maybe years now, maybe that's a natural trend, Martin Feldstein.
Well, but people were optimistic during the last couple of years from time to time, but we didn't see savings rates this low. So, yes, it's possible that this could continue at this level for a while, but I think the risks are on the downside. The risks are that people will not be willing to keep spending more than their incomes and that we will see a slowdown in the growth of consumer spending.
We saw that in
April, for example. In April, real consumer spending grew very little, and nominal consumer spending actually fell.
Let me take that point to Robert Barbera in Baltimore, if I may. Robert, what about this savings rate and consumer spending? Is it sustainable if debt's growing and savings are shrinking?
Yeah, I with all due respect to Professor Feldstein, those numbers bounce around month to month and are subject to rather extraordinary revisions. It's a residual. If you look at the spending numbers in April, he's absolutely right. They were soft. We did get the car sales for May, and they're quite strong. So it looks like the May consumer spending numbers are going to be up a pretty good bit. I certainly agree that we've had two bouts of false dawns before, and you can't say you know things are better. But home sales, home values, car sales, consumer spending, jobless claims, and the unemployment rate all look better. So there's some reason for optimism in here, but we're still in the wait-and-see mode.
Martin Feldstein, if you still see underlying weakness, then is that a signal that the Fed should continue to pump big money? $85 billion a month is what they've been doing, into the economy, into buying bonds.
See, I think the Fed has gotten themselves into a very bad situation because they have driven interest rates down artificially. The reason that interest rates are so low is not that the economy is weak, and the reason that they've ticked up recently is not just because some people see strength, but because they fear that the Fed won't continue this policy of artificially depressing interest rates. So the Fed has gotten out on a long limb where it's very hard to see how they can unwind their position until the economy is quite a lot stronger.
Maybe they don't need to unwind it. Maybe just sit on those bonds, let them expire in 5 years.
Well, even slowing the growth of purchases would. You saw what happened when Ben Bernanke hinted at that last week. Interest rates rose. And he himself said in his testimony that if the Fed were to prematurely slow or stop buying bonds, that could derail the expansion. So I think they're in a very awkward position, having gotten the markets accustomed to these unsustainably low interest rates. They may have to keep it there longer, waiting for the economy to be really quite strong before they take the chance of raising rates.
But isn't it inevitable for interest rates to rise as things rebound? I was quoting to Robert, but Paul Volcker, the former Fed chair, was talking last week about 1949 and government debt exceeding 100% of GDP, way deeper than now at that point after World War II. Interest rates went up, but, you know, he said that was fine because it was for good reasons. You got a healthier economy. Can we repeat
that?
What
happened back in those years was that the fiscal deficit, we had some years with deficits, some years with surpluses, but for 15 years there was no increase in the size of the national debt. This year alone, the debt will grow by over $600 billion. So for 15 years, starting in 1949, there was no increase in the national debt. And so with the economy growing, the debt-to-GDP ratio could come down. And that's what happened.
Robert? I would point out, Professor Feldstein, during the Reagan administration, with a very large growth in the debt associated with very large deficits, we had a similar situation in 1983-84. The Fed had been easing dramatically. The economy then took off. And over that period, long-term interest rates went up by 400 basis points. Mm-hmm. They went up by 400 basis points. A consequence of strong growth, the economy slowed in 86. And there was no untoward event, notwithstanding big deficits and a big rise for interest rates associated with the end of Fed ease.
How about it, Martin Feldstein? That takes us back to your wheelhouse then, and the Reagan years.
Well, we had a major tax cut. We had government spending coming down. So there was a lot of confidence about the fiscal future that's not there now.
But the point you were making mm-hmm. was if we're in an environment where the economy is strong, we're still at risk for a rise of interest rates. And in fact, that is the certainty associated with an economy that takes off.
There's a very big difference. Right now, mm-hmm. interest rates are artificially low. They've been kept down by the Fed. If you go back to the early 1980s, the interest rates had been pushed up appropriately by the Fed to deal with double-digit inflation, and the Fed was then able to start bringing those interest rates down to more normal levels.
But the Fed took the Fed funds rate from 21% to 8%, created the greatest bond market rally in the history of the bond market, and then when the economy took off, they reversed course, and the bond got killed for 2 years. I don't think that's It was artificial in the sense that if the economy looked better, anybody who owned those bonds in May of 1983 mm-hmm. was going to get killed. That looks an awful lot like this.
Martin Feldstein, can we do it again?
No, I don't think it looks like this because, remember, right now we have a real 10-year bond rate which is negative. We have 2% yields on 10-year bonds less than the inflation rate. So to me, that's not sustainable. At some point, it has to rise. And I think that's a real risk that the economy faces. And the only way for the Fed to get out of that safely is to wait until there is strength. And, of course, there was great strength back in 1983-84. The economy was growing at a very strong rate.
But you'd acknowledge, Professor Feldstein, that if we get 2 years of strength and we've got a vibrant economy and in that environment interest rates go up, that the Fed, in fact, could declare victory rather than apologize.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that completely. If we have a couple of years of growth of the pace that we had in the early 1980s, 5-6% real growth,
they could have champagne if they get 3.5 or 4.
3.5 would sound pretty good now, but what's the problem with the Fed waiting then to begin to get out of its role that it's been in recently, Martin Feldstein?
I don't think – well, the problem is that these very low rates are distorting investment behavior. A lot of risk-taking is happening, whether it's loans or home buying or purchases.
You're saying people are risky in terms of loans and home buying in an environment where housing activity is 30% of its previous lows over the last 50 years?
Professor?
I'm saying that mortgage loans at 3% for 15 years fixed, that's a risky strategy of the banks. I'm saying that the so-called
Professor Feldstein, can you explain why is that risky? I mean, for people buying homes now, it looks great.
No, it's not for the people buying them. It's for the financial institutions that are making those loans.
And it's risky because 3% is going to look like a terrible return in a couple of years.
That's right, because when interest rates go back up, the value of those loans in the portfolios of the banks are going to fall.
But if that happens, but the rest of the economy is doing better, interest rates are higher, so they'll make higher returns on those, can't they carry that? Or are you predicting some kind of bank collapse with that?
I'm not predicting a bank collapse. I'm saying that that what the Fed is doing, and I'm not by any means the only one saying this, what the Fed is doing is driving portfolio investors, including banks and others, into taking significant risks, lending to emerging market countries at extremely low interest rates, putting very few conditions on bank loans in order to reach for yield. That's the kind of risk-taking that happened in 06 and 07 before we got in trouble before. I hope we're not getting into that kind of trouble, but I think these extremely low interest rates are a source of risk.
What's the alternative? If we don't bring interest rates down now to help stimulate the economy, couldn't we just stay moribund for years?
Yeah, can I just isn't that the way monetary policy works, Professor Feldstein? You're in the business of trying to restart. Well,
The Fed uses the term unconventional monetary policy. So they never did this before. They never bought long-term securities in these volumes. They never promised to keep short-term rates low. So I think that they are taking significant risks in terms of the way they are distorting the incentives for private investors.
Martin Feldstein, Robert Barbera, please stand by. We've got a lot of listeners been waiting to come in here, and I want to invite them in. Rochester, New York, Bob is calling. Hi, Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, hello. I'd like to echo a couple of Professor Feldstein's points and bring a whole new direction into this conversation.
Okay.
A couple things. Number one, I think the I was one of those people around in the 50s. I can't go back to 49, but I can go into the 50s and remember we had a booming economy. And what led the way was huge middle-class manufacturing jobs. I'm a Kodak retiree.
Okay.
And Kodak is shrunk. It disappeared, effectively.
Sure.
And in Rochester, New York alone, 63,000 manufacturing jobs had disappeared. On the other hand, you take Apple that does no U.S. manufacturing. So my point here is that our assumptions about a new economy or a growing economy to go back to where we were is fallacious. Tom, your point about maybe our economy being moribund is something that I think might we really need to take a look at. Over the last 10 years, how many jobs, middle-class manufacturing jobs, that generally people didn't need a college degree for, didn't need a technical degree for, but could come out of high school and go into manufacturing and make $20 or $30 an hour, those jobs are gone forever.
Everybody's so feeling that, Bob. Our time is short before the break. Let us pick it up. Martin Feldstein, here's our Kodak retiree, and you can understand how he might look at this, saying, where's the beef? Where are the middle-class, decent-paying jobs that can really bring this back, not just in the stock market, but for everybody?
Well, that's right. Manufacturing has been shrinking over the years, and it is not coming back now. The growth now is in service jobs.
That might be okay if they pay, but they don't.
That's right.
So do you have an answer to that, or is manufacturing just gone? Bob seems kind of pessimistic that it can be done, bring back that strong middle class.
I don't think
we're going to see significant manufacturing employment come back. Manufacturing production workers, the kind that he described, manufacturing production workers are less than 10% of entire employment in the United States. And we're going to get some benefits from the improvements in energy availability in the United States, particularly in the chemical industry, but it's not going to be a major job producer.
Bob, we've just got half a minute before the break. Can we bring kind of well-paying middle-class jobs?
Yeah, I think if our debate is about whether or not the Fed should be trying to restart the economy and push people into taking more risks, I think the answer is correct. But they're not omnipotent. And to argue that they have a magic wand that can get Kodak back in place with manufacturing jobs, That's beyond the pale.
But it really has to be about both, because it's not enough to bring back the market with just a small percentage of the country really playing in it. I mean,
But as Professor Feldstein said, 90% of the jobs are not in manufacturing, and that's manufacturing's been declining for 45 years.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the change in the economic weather and whether this is really it, the road to good times at last. Robert Barbera from the Johns Hopkins University Center for Financial Economics has joined us this hour. Professor Martin Feldstein is with us. He was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Reagan and a big voice in American economics for a long time now. With us right now from Truro, Massachusetts, is Robert Kuttner. He's co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, author of the new book, Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus possibility. Robert Kuttner, thanks very much for joining us.
Tom, thanks so much for having me.
So here's one of our listeners writing in saying, is this a joke? Have you ever heard of a dead cat bounce when you're talking about a better economy? Our listener says, Bob, a recovering stock market due to the Fed putting in $85 billion a month is not a healthy economy. What do you say, Bob?
I think the listener is absolutely right. There has been too much focus on the financial part of the economy, which is what caused the problem, and not enough focus on the real economy. And, of course, in the real economy, unemployment is still very high. Wages are still very low. Most of the gains, almost all of the gains in the past 5 years in this rather feeble recovery have gone to the very top. And the Fed is behaving heroically, in my view, but as Bernanke keeps pointing out, it's like trying to ride a bicycle with one wheel. The other wheel is fiscal policy, and we are tightening fiscal policy too quickly, too abruptly, because elites have this obsession with the idea that the budget deficit has to be brought down. You bring the budget deficit down too quickly before the real economy is back. You snuff out the recovery, and at best, as you said before the break, a moribund economy kind of putters along, but you never get the purchasing power of the great middle class back. And I take a moment and tell a story? I was at my son-in-law's graduation yesterday at Greenfield State.
Congratulations.
Community College, where he got his RN degree.
Yep.
And community colleges, educate something like 44% of the kids in this country. This is the bottom half of the class, both socioeconomically and academically. These are second-chance institutions. These are the institutions where, you know, people in the service economy, if they're going to catch a break, get educated. And they've had a 25% real cut in their budget since 2001. And, one of the certificates they give is in early childhood. Well, are those early childhood jobs going to be $7 an hour jobs, or are they going to be professional jobs comparable to a kindergarten teacher? And if you cut the federal budget too quickly, you end up shooting the economy in the middle class in the foot, and that's what we're doing with this obsession with deficit reduction.
Well, Bob Kuttner, hold the thought
there. Deficit reduction.
Yes, please.
Issue,
yes, please. Martin Feldstein.
Yeah, I think I agree with the point that's just been made, that we are tightening too much in the short run and not paying enough attention to the long run. It's the mistake the Europeans made, and it has pushed Europe into recession.
Too much austerity too quickly.
Too much austerity too quickly. The key point is that we have long-term deficit problems, primarily associated with the aging of the population. Mm-hmm. Everybody understands that Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid can't continue to expand the way they are predicted to under current law, but you can't change those programs overnight. You have to give people warning that, for example, the retirement age is going to be postponed again, as it was in the early 1980s. So we ought to be focusing on these long-term fiscal issues instead of a sequester which does the kind of damage that was just described by Bob Kuttner, and the high personal income taxes, which are a drag on the economy. The fiscal drag this year is going to be almost 2% of GDP, just about as much as the economy grew last year.
So, Bob Kuttner, are you and Martin Feldstein in the same camp on this?
Well, I think we're in the same camp on the point that, and it's a pleasure to hear Professor Feldstein say we're having too much austerity too quickly. Bravo. I'll send him a copy of my book. But I think on the long-term fixes, I would be for much more public investment, short-term, long-term, because I think that's a key ingredient in generating the middle-class service sector jobs. And his version of a Medicare fix and my version would probably be very different. The idea of converting Medicare to a voucher, as a lot of the Republicans want to do, I think that would just shift more costs onto consumers, onto elderly people. Yesterday's Times have articles about, you know, the cost of routine procedures in this country, several thousand dollars.
Yeah, for over the top.
For procedures that are treated as public health screenings in countries that have universal systems. So we disagree, I think, on the long-term fix. But, you know, I call my book Debtor's Prison because we need debt relief. We need debt relief for students who have now incurred $1 trillion of debt. We're sandbagging the next generation. We need debt relief for the 1 in 5 homeowners who are still underwater. And the risk that Bernanke is taking in the absence of fiscal stimulus and putting it all on monetary policy is that the cheap money goes to the wrong people. It goes to pump up the same kind of financial market bubbles, speculative bubbles that caused the collapse. It doesn't trickle out to ordinary people who maybe can't get these cheap mortgages. It doesn't trickle out to ordinary businesses because the banks are too risk-averse to lend. And so unless the Fed becomes even more aggressive and does some of the refinancings that it's willing to do in the case of bad bank debt, maybe for student debt or for people who need mortgage relief, you know, they call it Helicopter Ben for dropping money. It's a quote from Milton Friedman. But the helicopter only drops money on Wall Street, and Wall Street doesn't pump the money out to the rest of the economy. One last thing. Professor Feldstein said the Fed never did this before, and I beg to differ. The Fed did this during and after World War II. The Fed said, we are going to buy enough Treasury securities to keep interest rates very, very low. We're going to peg interest rates, and that's how we were able to finance the enormous World War II debt. But we combined it with tight regulation of speculation so that the low interest rates went to underwrite the post-war boom. They didn't go to underwrite the kind of speculation that crashed the economy and that's generating some bubbles again.
Martin Feldstein, I want to bring that to you, but Bob Barbera first come in here. We hear some disagreement there, but is there common ground that we're just missing in Congress on a potential fiscal path out of this? We might hear some, you know, enough connective tissue between conservative Martin Feldstein, liberal Bob Kuttner. Is there common ground here that Congress is missing?
I think straightforwardly. The idea that we could have had some stimulus in the short run and tried to address our entitlement problems further out would have been much more sensible. It requires sort of keeping two thoughts in your head at the same time.
Yep.
And that seems to be beyond the way we worked it out in Washington.
You know, that was what the super committee was supposed to do. And the sequester was not supposed to happen because the super committee was supposed to find a way of dealing with the long-term deficit and avoiding the sequester. Instead, they failed.
But it failed. Maybe that was completely unnecessary.
No, it failed. It failed because the Republicans and the conservative Democrats on that committee put deficit reduction ahead of everything else. And it's a completely misplaced obsession.
Martin Feldstein, what about that? That emphasis on deficit reduction at that point?
The point is that we should be focusing on deficit reduction in the long term rather than in the short term. And that's something that could be done by changing our tax rules to limit the tax subsidies that are cost billions of dollars a year, and by modifying the rules for Social Security and Medicare. And we could disagree about the exact way that should be done, and that's what Bob Kuttner was saying. But I think the idea that we have to slow the growth of those entitlement programs, which are forecasted to be the overwhelming increase in costs in the coming decades, I think is something that both sides should be able to agree on and then try to figure out what the best way is to do it.
Bob Barbera, is there a scenario where growth does kick in here and we grow our way past that deficit nightmare, those long-term deficits, or it's just waiting to be solved?
Yeah, I think in the short run, we certainly have the opportunity to be surprised on the upside. The good news is we didn't go off the fiscal cliff, so we didn't join Europe in being completely imbecilic. In terms of the long term, if you look at the medical care costs, Bob Kuttner gave us an anecdote, so let me give you one.
Yes.
A lot of us are at the age where we're having to deal with parents who are struggling, you know, in their late 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And you can watch a movie where for 6 months somebody's really tortured by the medical system before they pass on to the next life. If the baby boomer generation watches their parents die and decide that they'd rather get a six-pack and a carton of Marlboros and wait out the last 3 months, if we have a change
rather
in
than
attitude,
an extraordinary spending on the last months of life, okay?
And we all know the numbers, right?
Yep.
60% of what you're going to spend in your life you spend in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. If you had that sociological change, then all of these forecasts are way off the mark. And I'm not saying that that's true, but I do remember a forecast of a $5 trillion surplus that was made in 2000 that was off by about $8 trillion. So feeling supremely confident about how the world will look in 2035 strains credulity.
Let me go to Edward in Lexington, Massachusetts. Edward, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm not really seeing any green shoots in the line of work I'm doing. I'm a industrial control electronics PCB designer at printed circuit boards. And
engineer.
I've seen in the last 8 months is sort of like a pause and a hold. The only jobs around I see are the green shoots are a weed field of low wage jobs, part time that the income from those doesn't even pencil out, and a lot of them can't fill them.
Yeah.
And so, what I'm wondering is this economy all fully recovered now? Is this the new normal? I'm not seeing anything that tells me anything different than that.
Bob Barbera, where does the better scenario come from? If the green shoots, as our caller says, you know, give us a weed field of low-paid jobs, nobody's going to be happy with that.
No,
Martin Feldstein says manufacturing is not coming back. You say services, but we've ridden that pony for a long time now without wage growth.
Yeah, no, I agree with both Professor Feldstein and Bob Kuttner. I mean, the notion of a big pickup in high-paying jobs with this unemployment rate is quite unlikely. What I'm saying is there's some chance. Some of the data suggests we might be on a higher trajectory for growth. That would mean a better trajectory for employment growth. But until you get that unemployment rate down at least another percentage point, the hirers rather than the unemployed are going to be in the driver's seat on negotiating, and so the wage increases are going to be quite modest.
But isn't it more than just the rate of employment, Martin Feldstein? Isn't what people are doing, the amount of value they're creating, if it's...
That's absolutely right. And I think there's a growing recognition that our education system is failing because it's not producing the kind of education, the kind of training that the market rewards. So we've got high school graduates who don't have any technical skills. We have college graduates who don't have any really marketable skills. And we need to change that. We need to reorient what we're doing in our educational system.
Let me go to Joe in Boston. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi. I'll just be brief. Great conversation. I wanted to say, I think the economy in itself, we're in it damned if we do and damned if we don't. If we don't lower interest rates, we can't create jobs. However, it's kind of a false, it's going to be a false promise at the end when interest rates go up, there's going to be inflation and cause some more problems. So I think in terms of that and with the economy in itself, the way it is, with the deficit and the job situation in terms of no really good jobs out there in service industries, as you're discussing, and the lack of the elasticity that we have actually in, like they say, priming the pump is not really there anymore.
Joe, give us an example. When rates go up, what do you see happening? What in your life would change?
Well, I mean, what I would see is I would see like the market in housing, for instance, people buying homes currently right now at 3%. Now every time a house goes, every time something goes up, an interest rate goes up 1 point, that cost of that house goes up 10%. I mean, so you know, down the road, it's going to affect the housing market.
Maybe bring those prices back down. Bob Barbera, how about it? People celebrating home prices up 10%, biggest in years. If we get higher interest rates, do those prices just come back down?
Well, actually, traditionally now, if you get a rise for interest rates, people who've been on the fence tend to move in. So, the economy is bouncing along the bottom. If it has firmed, and it does appear to have firmed in housing, what you typically see is if rates begin to go up, you get an acceleration and some further firming. It's not it would not be
people trying
unusual.
To get in before they go up higher, you mean?
That's right. And that's, you know, if you look at the last five business cycles, that's certainly what it looks like, right? This was the most unusual in housing. Remember, though, that housing now is rebounding from an unprecedented low level. And so I still think housing could withstand, you know, a 50 basis point rise for interest rates.
Martin Feldstein, when are you going to feel some confidence that we've got our feet under us on the economy?
Couple of quarters of 3.5% growth. That's what I'd like to see. I think that's what everybody would like to see, and that would certainly give me confidence that things are at last moving in the right direction.
Bob Cuttner, are we on that path in your view?
No. I think as long as Congress keeps on this track of premature deficit reduction, as long as wages don't go up, as long as unemployment stays high, we continue to be in this vicious circle where we sputter along and the potential of the economy is not realized, and that's why we need to stop the austerity.
Stop the austerity. We'll see what happens when that conversation gets going again a little later this year. You've all given us a lot to grab onto as we look at the economy in this really interesting moment, maybe changing gears. In what direction, we're still holding our breath to see. Robert Cuttner is author of the new book, Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity Versus Possibility. Bob Cuttner, thanks for joining us today. Robert Barbera, Johns Hopkins University Center for Financial Economics, thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thank you.
And Martin Feldstein, former Chief Economic Advisor to President Ronald Reagan. Thank you very much, Professor Feldstein.
Thanks very much.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.